Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time, and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
And the crowd went narcoleptic. Hello, this is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. Thank you, Claire. That was my granddaughter, Claire. She's 9 years old. She'll almost be 10. She comes in, does all that. That's just one person in the audience. That's Claire. Thanks, Claire. Time for bed. Thanks again. Say hello to your folks. Sweet child. Like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama, like sweet home Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. In other words, they don't charge us a fee for doing this because they believe in what we're doing, and we believe in what we're doing. It's a we program. I tell my sponsees, why does it say we? First word in the 12 steps is we. Why we? Because we stay sober. I get drunk. Wow. That's the we. Who includes the we? That's the other interesting part. Who's the we? The we is your sponsor, God, and the program. That's the we. I also like to acknowledge my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist, and he does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe as the families go, so does the country, so does the nation, basically so does the world. It's the breakdown of the family, I believe, is causatory to most of our problems with alcoholics and drugs, most of our other problems as well, but it manifests itself in alcoholics and drugs. According to Google, and you know Google, 1,000 years hence, the anthropologists will have concluded that as a society, they all commune with an all-knowing God named Google. And according to Google, there's 140 million drunks in the world today. I don't know if Google went out and interviewed all 140 or where that number came from, probably percentage. There's 2 million in the rooms as of last count in 2010. So there's quite a disparity between the people that are getting recovery and those people who need recovery. I'd like to say that the program of recovery is for people who want it, not as so much for people who need it, because if everybody who needed it was in there, it would be standing room only, and that's not really what the case is. Although I believe we're building up, we're coming to new horizons. Rum Radio is part of that. It's a very tiny part, but the understanding is going back to a basics understanding of sponsorship. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. One drug addict talking to another drug addict. One-on-one. If you think you could change the world, it's in either grandiose romanticism or politics. You only change the world one man at a time. So you go out there and you change that one guy. You know what? Not only have you helped change him, you change yourself by giving of yourself, which is not an addict, an alcoholic's first call. It's unnatural, I tell you. Natural man has been an enemy to God and has been so since the fall, and the winter doesn't look much better. The alcoholic, self-centered in the extreme. Self will run riot. So why would I want to help somebody? Because recovery tells me that there's a better way to live my life. And it is. Harold, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Joseph. It's nice to be here. And I consider it an honor to be able to give back. I'm every week I'm amazed at some of the situations that I see, families, problems that families have gotten themselves into. And by and large, what I'm seeing is that dads need to spend more time with their kids. It is amazing. But I'd like to make a couple of announcements. One is that our chat room is open, so you can go to rumradio.org, click on the live button, and then when that takes you to Blog Talk Radio, you can get to the chat room on the right-hand side of the page. If we have callers who would like to call in, our number is 949-534-0621, 949-534-0621. And finally, I'd like to acknowledge Joseph for funding everything. He does not make money from the website or the radio program. In fact, it costs money, and he shoulders that cost as his way of giving back. And I'm glad he does. That gives me a method of giving back. And it's just very important. Stopping is fairly easy, folks, but staying stopped, that's where the 12-step programs come in. It helps us get rid of our selfishness and turn that selfishness into humility, pride into humility, and the selfishness into selfless giving. So that's what has made the biggest difference for me. And the best way to do that is to find someone to help. That's when the principles really take root in our lives. So that's what this program is all about, and I'm glad to be here. I'll turn it back over to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. I like to think of humility like underwear. You know why?
Why?
Humility is like underwear because it's necessary unless it shows. It's essential. But if it shows, it becomes indecent.
Absolutely.
Before I introduce our host, we have a man of note tonight. Rodney A.
You mean our guest?
Our guest. Did I say host again? I did that last week, too. I'm going to have to change a cog. Excuse me, I got a cog change. Our guest for tonight, Rodney A., he's a man of note. You know, we like to do people of note because they have better jokes. And we also do the common Joe because who can put a yardstick on a miracle? But we're real excited about our interview for tonight. Are you there, Rod?
Yeah, hi, Joseph. I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay, so if you could just hold on for a moment, and we'd like to get one more thing out of the way. In most meetings of recovery, we usually start with a prayer. Usually it's called an invocation. And then all meetings of recovery are, no matter whatever the topic spin is, it's not really, doesn't matter all that much. All meetings are gratitude meetings. The attitude of gratitude is a prayer unto God. And then we end with a prayer. It's called a benediction, which thanks the Spirit for being among us, a sense of well-being. One of the other things we usually do, in this neck of the woods anyway, we read how it works. And if you've gone to meetings on a regular basis, you've heard this, no telling how many times. In every meeting, they repeat it. And I went to my sponsor early on after a couple of years, and I said, you know, I said, I've heard this so many times. I said, you know, shouldn't we dispense with this so we could go on with the meeting? Because I always have so many words and so few thoughts. And he said, well, Joseph, it's still all about you, isn't it? Well, we don't say it for you. You say it for the man who just walked through the door, the new man. Oh, say? See, I never got stuff like that. And what I've learned is the newcomer is life's blood to AA. Just like the old timer is the backbone. But relapse is the soul. Because there's nothing so tormented as a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. And speaking of that, this is not AA. This is not Alcoholics Anonymous. This is an NA. This is not Narcotics Anonymous or CA, Cocaine Anonymous. This is Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. If you hang in the whole hour, you might think it's Narcotics Anonymous. No, it should be a really good show tonight. So I'd like to start out with how it works. From the this is found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the big blue book or the big book. It's on chapter 5. I like using the big book because it's the original template of all 12-step programs. All 12-step programs come from the understanding found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's other flavors of addiction. They're all over the place. You name it, we got it. But the original template comes from this book. And I like to go back to the original template. And then you could always read any of the other and some really great stuff and other books. But this is the basic template. This is the original understanding that developed the 12 steps of recovery. Also for... It's also the repentance process. People don't get that, but I have to – it's a spiritual malady. So I have to address this also in a spiritual way. I just wrote a post on there. As we grow spiritually, are we opposed spiritually? For nothing grows without opposition. That was a very interesting post on Facebook. Some people accepted it. Some people ignored it, and some people challenged it. So it made a lot of good conversation. And this is how it works from Chapter 5 in the big book, page 58. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. There are those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. I'm kidding, born. They are not at fault. They are naturally, necroblondes, they are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection with care, with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6 were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7 humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8 made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9 made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10 continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11 sought through prayer and meditation, to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything but perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and the personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and see that God could and would if he were sought. Well, that's enough out of me. And so the way we do this, Rod, is that if you would, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and then what keeps you in maximum service. So tell us, when was the first time you realized or the first time you drank that it rang your bell?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, first of all, Joseph. Okay, it's an honor and it's a pleasure, too. I grew up in England, as you could probably tell from my accent. I still got a slight English accent. And in a town in Nottingham, of Nottingham in England, central England, you know, coming from a working-class family that pretty much made, you know, the transition from working class to middle class by the time I was like in my late teens, 20s, they both worked very hard. Neither one were alcoholics, but I had a grandfather who was an alcoholic. And when I started drinking, which was very early, 15, 16, going to pubs, because you could then, and even sometimes now in England, you can go into a pub at like 15 and 16 and they'll serve you a lot of times. And it was apparent, although I didn't really know it, but obviously my behavior showed it, that I had a problem when I started drinking. I didn't need to drink all the time, but when I went out with my friends, I didn't want to stop drinking. And that happened like through my teens and into my early 20s somewhat. I never drank at home. To me, drinking at home, even later in life when I was basically drinking as much as I could, I had to be out amongst crowds. I had to basically, because I was somewhat shy, I had to get the courage to show who and what I was, which in my opinion was brilliant, sarcastic and funny and unusual and different. And in order to do that, I had to have a lot of drinks in me, you know. So it wasn't until really in my late 30s, that I started to think I may have a problem. I never considered myself having a problem because I would only get drunk like probably twice a week, sometimes 3 times a week. But I would get drunk until I couldn't find any more booze and I couldn't get a hold of any more cocaine to keep me sober, so I could, you know, relatively sober, so I could keep drinking.
Right. How old were you when you first... You first drank, though. When was the first time? Were you like 12, 15, 20?
I was about 16. I was about 16 when I first started going into pubs. And, you know, with some friends, I went to a community college type of educational system in England at that time. We started younger there. And it was about 16, and I would kind of go down the pub at lunchtime and have a few beers and then go back to class and, you know, try to get through the rest of the afternoon. But I was about 16 when I first started, yeah.
So you notice, okay, so you drink the first time you're in the pub and you feel like you've come. This is a rite of passage, going to the pub, having a couple stouts, I think. Yeah, what you call it, stout, right?
Yeah, we drank beer, which we call bitter. It's not really bitter. It's just a form of beer. It's like a lager, a little bit heavier. And it was the normal thing to do if you're in England. And, you know, you didn't get a six-pack from 7-Eleven or whatever like we do in this country or get somebody to buy it for you. We just went into a pub and drank with our friends. And it was normal behavior. It was absolutely normal, nothing unusual about it. And, you know, it wasn't for several years that was my kind of modus operandi. I would, you know, and then I'd start going out with my friends at 17, 18, 19, and then, you know, going down clubs because I could drink longer. The pubs closed about 11 o'clock in England, and clubs were open until 2:30, and I would make sure we all went down the clubs because I didn't want to stop drinking. And,
right.
You know, so therefore it was pretty obvious to me, even in my late teens, early 20s, that, God, I really like to drink. But I like to drink a lot, and I don't like to stop drinking. You know, but I wasn't overly concerned about it. I was young. I could recover for the next day, even though I had horrendous hangovers. But, I got married when I was about 21, 22, and I hardly drank. At all. I didn't drink much at home, and then we went out with my wife and some friends. I'd probably have three or four beers or something, and that was about it. It wasn't until my marriage broke up and I couldn't see my daughter when I wanted to see her, like when I was about
24. Let me go back just a hair now. How would you do in school? You're drinking, and was it affecting your grades, or were you able to overcome that, or it didn't? You didn't see a problem.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. I got through it okay. I really did. Because I wasn't really going out all the time. And as I said, I didn't drink at home. I've never drank at home. Very, very unusual, unless there's friends over. I never drank by myself. And so I got through it okay. It was fine. Yeah, it was okay. It's only when I started working and I had access to more funds and more money that I started having a problem. So we're looking at, you know, 2021 when I started really, like, going out and staying out until 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, which changed somewhat when I came to the States, when I got into cocaine, et cetera, and I'd be up until 6, 7 o'clock in the morning drinking and snorting coke. So
how old
were
you now with the coke?
Excuse me?
How old were you now when you got introduced to coke?
When I used to do cocaine, I started doing cocaine about when I was like 25.
The only reason I did cocaine is because I liked the smell. All right, so you're at 24 now, and you found cocaine, and where are you now? You're in the States now?
I'm in the States. I'm in San Francisco. And San Francisco is a great party town, man. It really is. And I went to a British pub, and a lot of my friends were Brits, and that went to the pub. A lot of Americans, too. But that's when I got into cocaine, and I was the organizer. Like at around like 1 o'clock at night, I would start organizing where the coke is, and I'd get some more beers and some booze, et cetera. And we can party some more and keep going, and I would get very, very anxious if we couldn't drink and party like after 2 o'clock, you know, and that was very apparent because I was always organizing where the cocaine was going to be and where the booze was going to be, and we had to get it, go to somebody's house or somebody's place or something, continue drinking, continue using cocaine because I did not want to stop, you know, and a lot of people around me, they could just stop whenever they wanted to. You know, which kind of was unusual to me. I couldn't quite figure it out. Why wouldn't they want to keep smoking, you know, smoking dope and snorting cocaine and drinking booze until 8 o'clock in the morning? You know, I couldn't figure it out. But, and I was only one of, like, well, probably two or three of us that would want to do that constantly. So I was beginning to think I had a problem. Then by the time I was about 32, 33, after about 10 years of doing this, you know, I definitely knew I had a problem, but I was in denial. I did not want to accept it at all. You know, I really didn't. So we've reached about 33, 34, I guess, and then I finally got sober when I was 39 to 40, just around. I went out once, Joseph, after about 6 months with a friend and got drunk, and I was just like, I was horrified. I've been 5 months sober.
Yeah, let's back up for a second. Okay, and you say you went out. You stopped for a while, and you stopped on your own program. How did it stop?
Yeah, I did go to AA a little bit to begin with, a few meetings. I wasn't committed to it. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't really do much. And I bent to temptation when a friend said to me, let's just go out and, you know, have some fun. I haven't seen you in 6 months or so. And I said, okay, let's do it. You know, and it was a mistake, which it always is. And so we went out and partied and drank and got coke and stayed up till 6 o'clock, which was the modus operandi of a couple of people I knew. And I felt terrible. I couldn't go to work the next morning. I was just hungover. And I knew that I had to go to work every single day if I was going to keep my sobriety. And I knew that that's when I had to quit and quit for good. And that really made an impression on me. I'd reached bottom completely, you know. And so then I started going to the program 2-3 days later and managed to get to work every day, do my job, et cetera, and use the program as my crutch, which is obviously what I needed. And from that moment on, I haven't had a drink in 25 years now. And,
okay, now what you said, you used the program. Now, how did you initially use the program? You went to meetings, okay, so we get that. You went to meeting every day, twice a week, three times. How often did you go to meetings?
I would go between one and three times a week to begin with. I didn't go every day.
Okay.
That was enough for me. It's almost, I knew I would not drink again. And I know that there are alcoholics that can never really honestly say that. You know what I mean? But somehow, some way, I had given it over to God. I knew God with my answer of basically remaining sober. You know what I mean? And I knew, I really, really knew, Joseph, that I was not going to drink again. I know it sounds
now,
crazy.
Now, okay, so there was a bottom somewhere. I know it's a little foggy right now, but there's a bottom. I usually, my experience is that the pain is so great, the consideration of doing it again and calling on God is like, you're right there. So folks will call on God. What was the bottom look like? When did you finally... You called on God? Did you say, God, I need your help? Or what did you do? What did that look like?
Yeah, well, that one time that I went out and I drank and used cocaine, and I felt so horrible, I felt terrible. And I also knew my livelihood was at stake, my life was at stake. I was like 30, 39 going on 40 at the time, and I knew that I had to do something drastic. I'd had enough. You know, I'd been drinking, for God's sake, like for 22 years, 23 years, full tilt. And I wasn't getting, like, the high that I used to get. I wasn't having fun like I used to have. I was miserable and depressed. And I realized that, and, you know, talking about reaching bottom, that was my bottom. I had to change my life around because I was depressed, unhappy, miserable. And I had to do something with my life that was different from what I'd been doing. And that was my bottom. And obviously, you know, I had to keep my job and keep working, et cetera, to take care of myself. So that's when I handed it over to God and said, I can't do this. It's your job. You know, so that was the point after the 6 months of sobriety, the first day that I went out. After that day, that was enough for me. I was done. I knew I was done. You know, I really truly did. It was amazing. And I prayed every night, and I got through everything, and I haven't drank since. And later on, we'll go into the aspect of being what we call sometimes a dry drunk, or I was not drinking, but I wasn't sober. And I've really
right.
only gotten sober really in the last 2 years, even though I haven't drank. I haven't drank for 25 years now. Okay, but, you know, I've been in and out of program, but I've only been doing the program really seriously for like about 18, 20 months now.
Oh,
and,
okay.
I mean, it's amazing. And the bottom line, Joseph, on this is that you don't realize that you're repeating a pattern that you did, that you had when you were drinking. And a lot of that pattern had to do with, like, lying and slandering, cheating on women and stuff like that. And you know, that pattern was still inside of me. And I knew that, you know, I was, again, getting very depressed. I had a lot of problems making money, et cetera, in the last 10 years. Some problems, maybe. Even though I was doing major events and doing a lot of things that made me happy, I had a hard time maintaining a household with my partner, and she eventually left me after 26 years, and, you know, that kind of was my second bottom, you know what I mean, and became the basically the premise of, like, you know, I've got to stop doing the same thing over and over again, you know, basically if I want to get a different result. And now, this doesn't necessarily mean that I wasn't going to meetings. I did go to meetings throughout this period, intermittently, and I was also in a different meeting. I was in Debtors Anonymous, and I went to a few Al-Anon meetings, too. But I didn't take my program really, really seriously. And that, my program has really been serious to me in, like, the last maybe 20, 23 months, okay? And it started when I was in New Jersey, and the person I was with in New Jersey because I had to get out of L.A. where I lived because I was just going crazy with the industry, the business, the entertainment business. It was driving me insane. And I didn't do 30 meetings in 30 days, but I did do 30 meetings in 35 days. And that's what really, really shook me to my core and got me on the right path. And even though I've read the big book for years, even though I've been to meetings spasmodically for years, even though, you know, I had a sponsor at the beginning, et cetera, et cetera, my problem was is that I didn't drink, but I was not sober, you know. And it's interesting.
Let me interject. I find this to be quite common in the program.
Mm-hmm.
I had the same deal. I was counting on the meetings. I was trying to get the program a recovery through the process of osmosis.
Yeah.
You know what osmosis is? If I sit in enough meetings that the message is going to come through the floor, up the chair, up my butt, and into my head, and now I found an easier, softer way. Of course, I'm sober. And the big book says, a man coming out of the storm shelter after the hurricane. Gee, Mom, isn't it grand? The wind has stopped. We think a man unthinking who says sobriety is enough. Now, if you go into the meetings and you're not drinking and drugging, you're sober. Okay, I get that. But if you're not working a program as outlined in the big book and the 12 step with a sponsor, you might be sober, but you're not in recovery. That's where
right.
a lot of folks miss that. And they say, well, who are you to tell me what my program's supposed to look like? I'm not drinking. Is that not enough? I go, well, no, but it's your program. And if that's what you're comfortable with and that's what you want, that's fine. But I've learned, Bill W. said it, pain is the touchstone of all spiritual growth. And I believe that you can't grow spiritually and be comfortable at the same time. So I go to meetings because I'm comfortable in the meeting. We start with a prayer, invocation. All meetings are gratitude meetings, right? And so I get, and then at the end we have a benediction, a closing prayer. So I get my spiritual bump. My main interest is when's my next meeting, not am I turning my mind to someone I can help. And I believe that's where the program really comes into play. But, okay, you're in Jersey. Yeah. I don't know if you know this. Did you know that the devil lives in New Jersey? Did you know that?
I didn't know.
They have, during the Revolutionary War, it was determined there's a thing called the Jersey Devil. Matter of fact, they even have a hockey team called it. He's got his own team.
That's
called the Jersey Devils. If you cross the Gothel's Bridge from New York, you can smell brimstone. I'm telling you, if you ever never smell brimstone, cross over the Gothel's. There's a terminal, an oil terminal there. You'll smell brimstone. If that's not all convincing, I was married to Satan's wife, Satan's sister. My ex-wife lives in New Jersey, so that should close it up right there. Anyway,
right.
Okay, so you're in Jersey.
Yeah, and that's where I, you know, finally, I think, get the message. And even though I'm not drinking, and, you know, I don't really want to drink, and because of the business that I've been in for a few years, which is very social, and meetings are, you know, business meetings are conducted in restaurants and in bars, et cetera, a lot of times. I haven't drank, and I have absolutely no compulsion to drink. My biggest fight and battle is that I'm honest, that I live my life with humility, that I have acceptance, and that basically I feel good about myself. And this is the first time in many, many years, that, you know, in the last couple of years, that I started to feel good about myself and what I'm doing and what my program is. So, you know, it's an interesting journey, believe me, of being not drinking for 25 years, but probably in those 25 years, I've only been really sober and in recovery probably about 5 years, 5 or 6 years of those, you know. You know, and I don't know if other alcoholics are like that. And I mean, I have heard stories that people have come back to meetings after being absent for many years, and even though they haven't drank. And I'm just grateful that, number one, I'm able to, you give me, basically the opportunity to share this, and also the fact that I am in touch with the program, and I am in touch with God, which is of prime importance to me.
Now, when you finally met, did you find a sponsor and you started working the steps again? And going to meetings. You went to 35 meetings in 35 days. Mm-hmm. And you started. So you found a sponsor. Did you find him? Did he find you? And what did the steps look like?
Yeah, I found him at a meeting, and he's been my sponsor ever since. Yeah, the last over 2 years.
And you worked all the steps again pretty quick, I take it?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
How long did it take you to get through the steps at that time?
This time now?
Yeah, the last time you did it.
This last time. I'm still on the steps right now. I haven't completed them. I'm going through them, I have been doing for almost 18 months. About 18, 19 months I've been going through the steps.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm on step 9. And I'm taking my time, I'm getting through it, I'm doing it seriously, and I'm not playing around. And it's difficult for me to do it because, I mean, as we were talking before, I don't know whether I'm doing this, and I don't know whether it matters. It's like, do it because my sponsor wants me to do it, and I'll get applause for it, or if I'm really, really serious. And, you know, as we were talking before the show, it's like, you know, I loved what you put on Facebook earlier today, I think it was, about I can stop pretending to be being somebody else, now I can just pretend to be me. And those words really resonate with me. I just love them because I don't know who the heck I am, Joseph, you know, and I don't know whether I'm leading a spiritual life, if I'm I'm hoping I'm leading one, but I may be faking it. Does that make sense? But I feel that if I'm questioning it, maybe it is real. You see what I'm saying?
It's spiritual by nature. Let me give you this. It's spiritual by nature. It's in the scriptures. It says, through a glass darkly, face to face, not to be seen as I see myself or not to be known as I know myself. But then Thomas Merton, who was a Travestine monk, said if we could see ourselves like other people see us, we would truly be humble. Chiron, a French philosopher, said if we could see ourselves like other people see us, we would disappear on the spot.
Right.
And Robert Browning, the plowboy poet, said in a poetry to a louse, if we could see ourselves like other people see us, many a foolish notion it would dispel. So we really never get to see our complete. Now, I could see you and you can see me, but we never really get to see the whole picture right now. So what I've discovered is when I'm in the service of my fellow beings, I'm in God's will. And I don't really have to worry a lot about me. See, if I stay too much in my own head, it's a dangerous neighborhood, even after 17 years. So if I'm working with someone, if I'm trying to help someone else, it's sort of like a vacation. And I don't have to go through all that rigmarole trying to figure out what's going on. All I have to try to do is help the next sufferer, and then I'm okay.
That's right. That is correct. You're perfectly right on that. And, it's great what you're doing on this show. I really feel what you're doing is so important. And as I told you before, I'm proud of what you're doing. I think it's, you know, the message is as we've always said, is for the newcomer. And the newcomer is the lifeblood of the program. And, if you can touch and reach one person every show, or one person a month, it's remarkable.
I like to put it to you this way. The newcomer is life's blood to AA and ACA. It's the life's blood to recovery. Just like the old-timer is the backbone. But relapse is the soul, because there's nothing so torment as a head full of AA and a belly full of booze.
Yep.
The only reason for the AA program and the NA and the CA program is we're an organization, we're a group of fellows and women to go out and help the next sufferer. That's our only reason for being. That's it. But you can't give away something you don't have. So that's what we do. I like that people say, you know, Room Radio, it's a good, and I know it's a good work. It's 101% collaboration with God. God does 101% and I do all the rest.
Yeah. That's handing it over, isn't it? It really is.
It is. Yeah, it's all about finding God. I mean, that's a lot of folks have a hard time in the rooms of recovery. I wrote a post on Rum Radio, it's on there. It's AA threatens to fire God, demands more benefits and less participation. What I've discovered, though, it's not just about AA. Clancy I came up with the idea that he saw in some areas of the country they were elbowing God out of the rooms because of the rational recovery and, you know, the agnostic and, you know, and people having doorknobs. I say, you know, I warn them about having a doorknob for a higher power because eventually it'll turn on you.
Yeah. I just can't see it working. I mean, but that's just one person's opinion. But, I mean, for me, I could never make it unless I had God in my life. It's, you know. Impossible.
Well, they try, though. And what I've discovered, it's not really so much AA that's elbowing God out of the rooms. It's AA is reflecting the society it finds itself in. It's
exactly.
A microcosm of the general lay of the land. People are moving God out of the way. There's one lady from England in the chat rooms, which is nice because it's a worldwide affair and we get information from all over the world. And she said, you know, that's funny you should say that, Joseph. She says, I don't go to church. She says, my family doesn't go to church. She says, I don't know anybody in England that goes to church.
Yeah.
And I've heard that on Sundays the churches are just about empty. Of course, here, you know, I'm in Texas. That's sort of like the belt buckle of the Bible Belt. So we're a little bit more, you know, the South especially, not as much as the North, but it's sort of like a bastion of religious fervor comparatively to the rest of the world, which is kind of interesting. So, you know, it has the bounce here is that you're going to get saved and you're going to get sober through Jesus, and some people do. I belong to a fundamentalist church. They have their own 12-step program. So I invited myself. I offered my services to them, and what they told me locally was that, Joseph, you intimidate us.
Yeah.
And so I know too much. You know, they know.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
education
right.
Education is a form of intimidation. So
yeah.
I get that. And I tell them, I said, well, look, I'm trying to get AA under the roof in there. And they said, well, we have our own. And I ask them, if the 12 steps are not a gift from God, why have you adopted them? And if they are a gift from God, why do you feel compelled to change them? They work just fine the way they're laid out. People will come to an understanding on their own. Matter of fact, it's you can't give them milk, you can't give them meat, you got to give them milk. They'll come to their own understanding in their own time. But anyway, all right.
But
so
you
now
know,
you
I'd
work.
Like, I'd like to just say something because I met a guy. This is he's not in AA. He's not a drunk. Okay. I've been meeting him in LA, Los Angeles, for several years, and he used to read the Bible and do his stocks on his computer. And I met him at Starbucks, and we used to chat, and we used to talk, and I asked him once, I said, why do you think that we've become this incredible society that's all about greed, that's all about me, and which I have seen a change in America in the last 12, 15 years towards that concept of greed, the big corporations of total greed, of entrepreneurs just making it for themselves, of the culmination of all these hundreds and hundreds of billionaires that have cropped up in the last 10, 15 years. And his reply to me was something very, very interesting. He said, well, when do you think we stop having prayer in the mornings at school? And it suddenly hit me. Even if kids just say a prayer at school in the morning, and they don't really mean it, and they're not into it, but somehow maybe they were through osmosis, they were getting the message. And it's almost as if maybe without God in your life, that element of greed and selfishness is more pronounced, you know? And maybe this is what is the problem that we're going through in our country right now with this huge me syndrome, the selfishness, the greed aspect, and the accumulation of massive amounts of money for oneself. And that hit home to me like no other conversation I've had for years.
Interesting,
and I've had you know, so, I mean, I just wanted to bring that up because it seems there's something to it. You know, it really does. And you know, when we're kids, we don't, unless we really like it from a religious family, we don't really pay a lot of attention when we're in prayers, when we're 12, 14 years old. And, you know, we just happen to have to be there because that's what the school wants us to do. And it seems very fascinating to me that this whole greed syndrome started around the time, you know, when kids were starting to grow up after them not getting prayer in school. And I think it's something that could be debated, for, you know, at length with religious leaders and educationalists and so forth. And I think it's a valid point that needs to be looked at. You know.
Well, you're gonna, you know, the big book says every man, woman, and child internally has a belief in God, and if it's not the God of your fathers, it'll be a golden idol because it's a capitalist society. So that would be the next
right.
level of gold and silver. You know, I can, if I have enough money, I can get a doctor, I can buy a house, I can get a wife, I can live well. So all my energy goes to the god of gold. I've been there.
Yeah,
I've been there. I had, you know, yeah, God loved me so much that he took my idol away. It was quite a shock. I didn't like it. I wasn't happy. He treats me, you know, he loves me so much. He chastises me. I know where it comes from, and I'm honored that he would think that much highly of me, but, you know, I'm still like a child. I don't like it. I don't like to be chastised, even though it's from the creator of the universe. I don't like it, but I have to accept it, and that's part of the program that I've realized is that, you know, sometimes I just got to accept that this is his will and that I make the best of it, and he'll lay out where he needs me to go because I'm going to go where he's telling me to go. We've got that kind of relationship. He wins.
Right. Yeah.
Every time.
But, you know, it's so apparent that in Western civilization, in Western society, that we are programmed that unless we make money, we are not enough. You know, we are programmed that to be successful is to make money and to have power. When in actual fact, I mean, a lot of people, when they've made money, are not even happy. Forget about being successful spiritually. They are not happy and they're miserable and they're constantly striving and striving and striving for the next $100,000 million, you know, and it's a sick society that segment of society has gotten itself into. And I know that you're probably happier, although I can't put words in your mouth, that you're happier now than you were when you were much wealthier. You know,
I would tell you this. I've been rich and I've been poor. Actually, I like rich better. But I'm okay. I have to depend on God. I mean, that's just the way it my life is broken down. But I'm okay. I get a lot of joy.
You know something? It's probably, and again, I'm putting words in your mouth, and you've now probably reached a period of balance in your life where you could handle money much better as well. You know, that's important, that balance of, you know, spirituality and financial security is I feel very, very important. And I think financial security and prosperity is important as long as it doesn't become a selfish aspect of your personality and becomes everything is all about the money. And, you know, about striking a balance and being prosperous is the goal, I believe. And, you know, that's what I feel that we should all be trying to achieve. And being prosperous in order to spend time giving and helping other people is very, very, very important, completely. And as you have said that I heard before from you is that, you know, to give advice and to give mentoring, sponsoring other people is probably the greatest joy that you ever have, you know, and it's...
Yeah.
What is better than getting a smile on somebody's face knowing that the advice that you have given them has a way and a means of saving their soul, you know, and saving their life? I mean, there cannot possibly anything better than that. I mean, I don't care how much money you have.
For the folks that are not in recovery, when you get a new sponsee, and oftentimes we'll find this the case, because of the drugs and alcohol, they're spiritually dead. You could see it in their eyes. The eyes are the windows of the soul. The reason why that saying's been around forever is because it's true. That's why it's made the millennium leap. They're true. You look in somebody's eyes, they're dark. You see the darkness of the eye because drugs and alcohol has taken over. Their soul is not available to the light. And all of a sudden they start working the steps because of the pain. The pain has driven them in. They become teachable. And that's until they become teachable, you can't go. But they start working the steps, and at a certain point in the steps, usually it's around step 5, you'll see the light in their eyes that wasn't there before. What a joyous moment that is for the sponsor. Now, the sponsee is in, you know, he's doing good, too, but the sponsor could see that his work did that. Now, he didn't do that. God did that, but he was a conduit for God. What a joy that is. What an honor that is. And very rare that people have that ability to see that and to get that. It's one of the great privileges of being in the program of recovery.
That's right. It sure is.
Yes. I agree, too, that it's one of the reasons that I'm in the counseling field, and especially chemical dependency counseling, is that I get to see people coming in with that darkness around them, and after just a few weeks, I begin to see that light grow, and I see people change. It's really wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to mention right quick, last year I had an amazing experience because I have a web page, familytherapyhaven.com. I sometimes get calls, international calls, and people contacting me to help. And I got a call from a lady in Scotland, and she had a daughter who was 14, drinking heavily. And so I encouraged her to take the girl to a hospital, get a chemical dependency assessment, and take their recommendation and run with it. And so they went to a hospital and got an assessment, and there in Scotland, the hospital staff decided that this girl was just engaged in normal teenage drinking, which is a phrase I'm not familiar with here in the States. Normal teenage drinking? Wait a minute. The legal age is 21 here. But that lady was at her wit's end because she wanted to help her daughter. She was very afraid for her daughter's safety. Kids can have too much alcohol accidentally and drop dead. And it was alarming, and it was so disappointing to me.
Yeah, well, it's what I told you before when we started this whole conversation, that when I was 16 and 17, going into pubs and drinking and getting drunk in England is normal. Okay, so that's what it's looked upon, and it has become a great problem of major binge drinking, of kids just getting totally legless, you know, and can't even get home. And it's sad because, I mean, they seem to be getting younger and younger, and it's a horrible situation. And I mean, I was there. I was 17 and 18 when I started drinking heavily, and I remember. So, yeah, I mean, that's a typical response from a British doctor or a British hospital. It really is, and they tend to think that they'll grow out of it or something, but obviously, if you're an alcoholic or you have a tendency to be one, then you're just going to keep drinking and ruin your life.
Problem is when you add any chemicals, alcohol or drugs, to a developing mind, it changes the development of that child's brain.
That's right.
The brain does not finish developing until age 27. The brain research going on now is absolutely amazing, and it really gives us a much better opportunity to help people young and old alike, and we do have to listen to what they're saying, and we've got to get our kids away from drugs and alcohol.
Right.
So thank you for sharing that earlier. That sparked a memory of a very disappointing experience. It's, folks, if you're listening and you have kids that are drinking, it's very dangerous, very dangerous. They can accidentally have enough alcohol to shut off the signal from the brain to the lungs, and the child will lay there and suffocate. You'll think they've passed out, but they're actually dying. That's the way Roy Rogers' son died. He was at college and doing some binge drinking and died from alcohol poisoning. So really take note. Do not give your kids alcohol, folks. Do not do it.
Thanks, Harold. Okay. So, Rod, tell us now. I'm interested to hear a little bit about you put on
Now that you've gotten to the point of giving back, you've done some really extraordinary things. I mean, putting on a party in Red Square right after the fall of communism, and you're working with the trying to get the Israel and the Palestinians to agree on something. That's monumental right there, and the vets. That's wonderful. I'm a vet myself, and I could see, you know, the traumatization of veterans is pretty tough. They folks don't realize that combat and being an extended situation where your life's in jeopardy on a 24/7 basis wears. It wears thin, and then when people come back to living normally, they never really kind of make the transition, and trying to get help now from the VA is tough, because the economy was down and resources were limited, and they're not as quick to give out the needed help, but they do the best they can. But there's a whole army of guys out there that are desperate for help. So tell us about what you're doing.
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, in terms of, I've got an organization, myself and a few other people, called Homes for Vets Now, and basically what we're attempting to do something that hasn't been done before, and, you know, and if you know something about my history, creating helping create the first concert on the Red Square after the fall of communism, I always liked somehow to do, because of my grandiosity issues, like to do something the first that's ever been done. That also applies to myself getting contracts with a former leader of the KGB, and in terms of his publishing, film, and TV life, and a couple of other projects that I've done similar to that. But our vets project is a priority in my life. And the reason is because on any given day, there's anywhere between 80 to 120,000 homeless veterans on the streets of our country, of our nation. And there are many organizations, Joseph, there are many federal programs, there are many privately funded programs that are trying as best they possibly can to help remedy this situation. After a lot of research and discussion and so forth, I basically came up with a program that I feel works, and that is, you can't put a Band-Aid on there. You can't throw a homeless veteran in an apartment and say, okay, now you've got a roof over your head, go ahead and change your life and, you know, be happy and be prosperous. And, you know, these people need help, and they need help in a certain specific way. And what our project at Homes for Vets Now is all about is creating sustainable living communities. Okay, and what I mean by that is that it's basically recyclable, it's organic, it's powered by solar energy, and we are creating homes out of shipping containers, okay? And
these That's terrific.
And they're inexpensive, basically about $8,000 to $9,000 to have a fully facilitated shipping container changed into a home, bathroom, kitchen, et cetera, water, electricity, you know, power, and for putting these shipping containers in a sustainable living community where not only are we having solar and eco-friendly power, not only do we create an agricultural co-op where the vets can work on the land, they can feel good about themselves being out there in the sunshine, being out in the fresh air, working with their hands and the soil, and growing plants and growing vegetables, growing orchards. We are also instigating a program for stress-related issues and also drug and alcohol issues. And as you know, and you're very much aware of it, you're a vet yourself, so many of the vets on our streets in the United States are drug and alcohol addicts. And this is a very important issue. It's immense. So what we've done is, we've gotten some land in West Virginia now. We've got 102 acres. We're working on getting some land in Central California in the Fresno Central Valley area of the state. And and we're putting on concerts, and we're doing fundraising and donation drives to help facilitate our ability to place these sustainable living communities and putting our homeless veterans in them. And several people have told us that this is like an incredible program that has never been attempted. The VA do everything that they possibly can to house and home, but, you know, make homes for our vets. But as I said, you have to look at every single issue here. You have to look at the therapy they need. You have to look at the fact that these people need to work and build their self-esteem through gaining prosperity, through gaining the
That's
fact
right.
that they can take care of their families. And so to create these communities and have everything that we need for that homeless veteran in this one community is what we feel at Homes for Vets Now is the hopefully the answer. And we don't know. We don't know how it's going to work, but if we feel that if we do the program the way that we've got it sketched out, the way that we plan it, that it's going to be successful.
It sounds terrific. How can people support that? Let's get some phone numbers out there and email addresses.
Yes, yeah, sure. And we've got a website. People can donate. They can help with fundraising, et cetera. They can help market. Our project is sponsored. And our web address is www.homesforvetsnow.org, O-R-G. We're a nonprofit corporation. And any way that people would like to help, all they have to do is go to our website. They can donate. They can email us. And I'd like to give you my personal email. People, if they want to contact us directly, they can do. And my personal email is rodnisnow26@gmail.com.
So let's spell that out.
Okay, R-O-D-N-E-Y-S, R-O-D-N-E-Y-S, now, N-O-W, 26, @gmail.com.
Rodney's now
at 26.
Rodney's now 26. Why 26?
Yeah. That's my birthday, and they wouldn't accept the other email, like just Rodney's now. So I had to put, it's my birth date. It's not my sober date, okay?
Okay, all right.
Okay?
There you go.
Rodney's now 26 @email.com.
Gmail.com.
Gmail.
Oh, Gmail. Okay, I see you said email.
Gmail.
Okay.
I've got it, and I've got it on our chat room. And
that's great. The English and the Americans are on two nations divided by a common language. Is that it?
That was Winston Churchill. Yeah, we have the same legends, the same heroes, and we're a people separated by a common language.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I always like the British language has always been so fascinating to me. Particularly, I always love Elizabethan English. I believe that's the purest form of the language. And they've had like because the King James Version of the Bible is in Elizabethan English. And a lot of folks, there's 128
right.
versions of the King James Bible right now because of that. And I ask people, I says, well, wait a minute. If the language wasn't the purest form, you don't see 128 versions of Shakespeare, do you?
Right. That's very true. Yes, I know. And, you know, you're talking about Elizabethan language, and it was very close to not being Elizabethan because, I mean, her father, Henry VIII, obviously, you know, he changed the whole concept of religion and the religion from Catholic to Protestant. And then his first daughter, Mary, changed it back to Catholicism, and that only through the grace of God, I guess, that Elizabeth had remained alive during that time to become the queen. So you'd be saying it was Orwellian English or, you know, or something else. But
and then you had the Spanish was coming over with the Armada bringing the Inquisition. Everybody was going to have their heads chopped off.
That's right. Yeah, the Spanish wanted to go back to Catholicism, and she sent English. The only way we defeated the Spanish Armada is by setting fire to our ships, our own ships, and sailing them into the Spanish ships. Okay,
right.
So
who was that, Drake? Who did that? That's
the Francis Drake. Yeah.
That's fascinating. And then, of course, there was the worst storm in 100 years when the Armada
that's
was
right.
coming over. So yeah, so I see God with his hands in a lot of stuff like that.
Well, I mean, the English are so arrogant that we always say, and I hope this is not too blasphemous, is that God is obviously an Englishman. You know, so.
The sun never sets on the English ego.
That's so true. Believe me, that's so true. And you know, we talked about this before about the fact of like, do I have an ego or don't I? And when I look at the project that we're doing, our Homes for Vets Now project, is am I doing it for my ego? I mean, am I really, you know, to get the accolades and the applause, etc., or do I really mean it? And this is like a very important question for me in my sobriety, I am an egomaniac. I have a lot of entitlement. I feel entitled. I should be taken care of and given money for just walking on the face of the planet and so forth. And so, I mean, the fact that we're doing it and we're going to make it happen and it's gotten so far in such a short time, I think that's all that matters, you know, in the end. And you were very good about pointing that out to me earlier, that, you know, that, Rod, you're delving too much into your thoughts in all of this. And the fact if you're helping people and you're doing the best you can to help people is enough. And I'm hoping that's the case, you know.
No.
So,
there's always that quest, especially in the program, because, egomaniacs with a low self-esteem, always trying, you know, some of the very wealthy people I know have very low self-esteem. There was a story that came around. A fella had $100 million. Like, he got scammed out of $10 million. And his friends were telling him it was a scam, but he said, no, this is a good deal. Well, he lost $10 million. He was so distraught by the loss of $10 million, he committed suicide.
Amazing.
That's ego.
That sure is.
He only had another $90 million, but the loss of that $10 million, he couldn't
handle
reconcile
that. I mean, that is not a happy man. That is not a happy man, even with his $100 million before he lost.
No, because his identity.
Right.
He lost some of his identity.
Yeah. Now let me ask you a question. Joseph, you're a veteran, correct? You're a veteran, correct?
Yeah, sure. Uh-huh. Combat veteran.
Which war were you, like, in combat, or were you...
Vietnam.
You know? So you went to Vietnam. Did you go to Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. Well, you had to be in combat. So my worst combat was with my ex-wives. But, yeah, you had to go to Vietnam.
I know. It's just fascinating because, you know, there's still thousands and thousands of, troops that went to Vietnam that are still on the streets. I mean, this is incredible to me, you know, the fact that, and they've been on the streets for 30, 40 years. And,
that's right.
I mean,
and the suicide
rate
is appalling.
Oh, it's incredible. And I think this is why I'm basically pleading to Americans almost to help us out with this. Because the last thing I want to do is send out a press release and say, why the heck is this Englishman in charge of this organization and feeling more for American veterans than Americans do? Do you know what I mean? And the point
That's
is...
That's a good question.
You know, it's not about nationality. You know, this is
the whole thing.
It's about your love of God and what is in your heart and doing right by your fellow man. And the fact that there's 100,000 American veterans that signed up to serve and protect their country that are on the streets of this nation. And I'm so frustrated about this. I'm so passionate about it. And we have got to do something about this. It's an embarrassment to our nation. Okay?
It certainly is.
You know, this is a very common, people don't realize, they don't look at history. After World War One, the veterans were promised $1,500 bonus. They never got it,
right.
You know, because there was the cardboard city outside of Washington, and they used, I believe it was General Blackjack Pershing was the guy that had to get rid of, they assaulted the veterans who put up the shanty outside. I believe Patton was there as a captain also. So this isn't uncommon. Once the battle is over, once the war has won, the soldiers are just, you know, the cannon fodder anyway, and they have to do this. And so people don't look at it, you know, that this is just part of the deal. You know, and as young men, they want to go to war half the time because of the glory.
Yeah.
So it's after the fact that, you know, that's when they need the help, when they get into the ditches and they get into the war and they see the death and the carnage, you know, the bands of war have been loosed, and this is when the rehabilitation needs to happen from a grateful nation. But people turn their backs. They don't want to know it anymore. I think it's just human nature. I think it always happens.
It will always happen.
They
embrace the warriors when they're in battle. You know, they embrace them as if like they're doing something wonderful and fantastic for our country, and they're basically, you know, they're putting their life in danger by going to battle for our country. And then once they leave the battlefield and they're back into society, they're forgotten about. And it's terrible. And I hate to get so serious. But
you know why we have wars, though, don't you? You know why we have wars? Because of old men and young women. Old men that want to relive their glory days, and young women because they're like a man in uniform.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's obviously, you know, old white men that are basically, you know, creating so many of these wars anyway. And, you know, and the problem is, you know, they're sending not only white young men, they're sending minorities into battle too. And you know, we've just got to change this whole philosophy that, you know, politicians through self-interest, through corporate and society's supposed enhancement, we have to go to war. And, you know, there's a lot of profit in war, believe me. All the munitions that are being built go to war. And then obviously you have to build up the nation and basically construct cities and construct dwellings and hospitals and roadways after the war. So there's contracts out there worth billions of dollars for corporations to build up the countries that we've just bombed. So there's a lot of money.
Let's rebuild it.
Yeah,
I know. It's great. War is a form of insanity, a wholesale form of insanity. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, I mean, the most amazing thing I've heard about war, and this was the First World War, which was between the European theater, obviously, for the Europeans, was 1914 to 1918. The Yanks came in about the end of 1916, beginning of 17. But, you know, what I heard was that the Brits needed to basically thin out the working class population because they were getting too powerful, you know. And so obviously, a war is a perfect solution, you know. We can't have the working classes getting the vote and taking over the nation, you know. So.
Yeah, they don't know. Well, they don't know. These people can barely read. They can't control their own lives. How are they going to control the nation? I've heard the argument.
Right. You know, it's fascinating. So, I mean,
well, that's
anyway.
A great work you're doing, Rod. That's amazing. I can't as being part of that group. I really applaud that. And yes, I still see veterans out there with their little cardboard signs and one leg, and it's in the rain, in the winter, in the hot, in the miserable bugs, and they got, you know, veteran, give me a couple, you know, can you spare a couple bucks, you know, and a lot of people roll up their window and they don't want to, you know, and they're shunned again.
Yeah.
So it's a sadness,
a
you know.
Thing. Yeah, denial is a wonderful thing. It really is, you know. So
I'm on your website now, homesforvetsnow.org. It's a wonderful website. There's a place you can click to donate. There's a place you can click to volunteer, homesforvetsnow.org. So I want all of our listeners to go there and get involved. This is terrific.
And thank you so much for that. We need all the help we can get, and it's been wonderful talking to you, Sue. Okay?
Thank you, Rod. Thank you, Harold, for coming in. I appreciate your efforts and your time, both of you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just want to say one thing, Joseph.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's you know, we talk about program how when you share, you know, supposedly that the audience that you're sharing to gets a lot out of it, but in actual fact, the person doing the share gets even more out of it. And that's been the case for me doing this. I want to thank you because, you know, it's just like a meeting. I was a speaker, and I got so much out of it more than anybody else did that might be listening. And I want to thank you for that. Okay?
You're quite welcome. I agree 100%. That's really the way it works. We change the world one man at a time. I believe that. That's the case.
And
so thank you
so
for your
much.
Time and thank you for your service. Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you, Harold, too. Okay? Bye, Joseph.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
It is my privilege.
Bye.
Bye.
In closing, I'd like to remind you that Rum Radio and rumradio.org, we're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 300,000 and 400,000 hits to the website. We're around the world, folks. It goes around the world, and it helps a lot of folks. We don't make any money, and we do this as a service project. All glory goes to God, so this is the guy who's in charge of this thing, and we appreciate any that you push this out. Open your mouth and pass it on. Use the tools laid at your feet. Open your mouth and pass it on. Remember, and if you're looking for sponsorship information that's solid in all program and will help the next suffer, you go to, remember where we'll see you. We'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.